When Hal recovered consciousness, he found his father kneeling over him. He whispered, "But what happened, Father? Did we win?" His father shook his head without looking into his eyes and made a fuss of wiping the sweat and soot from his son's face with a strip of grubby cloth torn from the hem of his own shirt. "No, Hal, we did not win." Hal looked beyond him, and it all came back. He saw that a pitiful few of the Resolution's crew had survived. They were huddled together around where Hal lay, guarded by green jackets with loaded muskets. The rest were scattered where they had fallen in front of the gunpits, or draped in death upon the parapets. He saw that Abberley was tending Daniel, binding up the wound in his chest with the red bandana. Daniel was sitting up and seemed to have recovered somewhat, although clearly he had lost a great deal of blood. His face, beneath the grime of battle, was as white as the ashes of last night's campfire. Hal turned his head and saw Lord Cumbrae and Colonel Schroeder standing nearby in deep and earnest conversation. The buzzard broke off at last and shouted an order to one of his men. "Geordie, bring the slave chains from the gull. We don't want Captain Courtney to leave us again." The sailor hurried back to the beach, and the buzzard and the colonel came to where the prisoners squatted under the muskets of their guards. "Captain Courtney," Schroeder addressed Sir Francis ominously, "I am arresting you and your crew for piracy on the high seas. You will be taken to Good Hope to stand trial on these charges." "I protest, sir." Sir Francis stood up with dignity. "I demand that you treat my men with the consideration due to prisoners of war." "There's no war, Captain," Schroeder told him icily. "Hostilities between the Republic of Holland and England ceased under treaty some months ago." Sir Francis stared at him aghast while he recovered from the shock of this news. "I was unaware that a peace had been concluded. I acted in good faith," he said at last. "But in any event, I was sailing under a commission from His Majesty." "You spoke of this letter of marque during our previous meeting. Will you consider me presumptuous if I insist on having a side of the document?" Schroeder asked. "My commission from His Majesty is in my sea chest in my hut." Sir Francis pointed into the stockade, where many of the huts had been destroyed by cannon fire. "If you will allow me, I will bring it to you." "Oh, please don't discommode yourself, Frankie, my old friend," the buzzard clapped him on the shoulder. "I'll fetch it for you." He strode away and ducked into the low doorway of the hut that Sir Francis had indicated. Schroeder rounded on him again. "Where are you holding your hostages, sir? Governor von der Velde and his poor wife, where are they?" "The governor must still be in his stockade with the other hostages, his wife and the captain of the galleon. I have not seen them since the beginning of the fight." Hal stood up shakily, holding the cloth to his head. "The governor's wife has taken refuge from the fighting in a cave in the hillside up there." "How do you know that?" Schroeder asked sharply. "For her own safety, I led her there myself," Hal spoke up boldly, avoiding his father's stern eye. "I was returning from the cave when I ran into you in the forest, Colonel." Schroeder looked up the hill, torn by duty and desire to rush to the aid of the woman whose rescue was, for him at least, the main object of this expedition. But at that moment the buzzard swaggered out of the hut. He carried a roll of parchment tied with a scarlet ribbon. The royal seals of red wax dangled from it. Sir Francis smiled with satisfaction and relief. "There you have it, Colonel. I demand that you treat me and my crew as honourable prisoners, captured in a fair fight." Before he reached them, the buzzard paused and unrolled the parchment. He held up the document at arm's length and turned it so that all could see the curlicue script penned by some clerk of the Admiralty in black Indian ink. At last, with a jerk of his head, he summoned one of his own seamen. He took the loaded pistol from the man's hand and blew upon the burning match in the lock. Then he grinned at Sir Francis and applied the flame to the foot of the document in his hand. Sir Francis stood appalled as the flame caught and the parchment began to curl and blacken as the pale yellow flame ran up it. "By God, Cumbrae, you treacherous bastard!" He started forward, but the tip of Schroeder's blade lay on his chest. "It would give me the greatest pleasure to thrust home," he murmured. "For your own sake, do not try my patience any further, sir. That swine is burning my commission." "I can see nothing," Schroeder told him, his back deliberately turned to the buzzard. "Nothing except a notorious pirate standing before me with the blood of innocent men still warm and wet on his hands." Cambry watched the parchment burn, a great wide grin splitting his ginger whiskers. He passed the crackling sheet from hand to hand as the heat reached his fingertips, turning it to allow the flames to consume every scrap. "I have heard you prate of your honour, sir," Sir Francis flared at Schroeder. "It seems that that is an illusory commodity." "Honour?" Schroeder smiled coldly. "Do I hear a pirate speak to me of honour? It cannot be. Surely my ears play me false." Cambry allowed the flames to lick the tips of his fingers before he dropped the last blackened shred of the document to the earth and stamped on the ashes, crushing them to powder. Then he came up to Schroeder. "I'm afraid Frank is up to his tricks again. I can find no letters of marque signed by the royal hand." "I suspected as much." Schroeder sheathed his sword. "I placed the prisoners in your charge, my Lord Cambry. I must see to the welfare of the hostages." He glanced at Hal. "You will take me immediately to the place where you left the governor's wife." He looked round at his Dutch sergeant, who stood attentively at his shoulder. "Bind his hands behind his back and put a rope around his neck. Lead him on a leash, like the mangy puppy he is." Colonel Schroeder delayed the rescue expedition while a search was conducted for his lost wig. His vanity would not allow him to go to Katinka in a state of disarray. They found it lying in the forest through which he had chased Hal. It was covered with damp earth and dead leaves. But Schroeder beat it against his thigh, then rearranged the curls carefully before placing it on his head. His beauty and dignity restored, he nodded at Hal. "Show us the way." By the time they came out on the terrace in front of the cave, Hal was a sorry object. Both hands were trussed behind his back, and the sergeant had another rope around his neck. His face was blackened with dirt and gun smoke, and his clothing torn and smeared with blood, diluted with his own sweat. Despite his exhaustion and distress, his concern was still for Katinka, and he felt a tremor of alarm as he went into the cave. There was no sign of her. "I cannot live if anything has happened to her," he thought, but aloud he told Schroeder, "I left Mevrouw van der Velde here. No ill can have befallen her." "For your sake, you had better be correct in that." The threat was more terrifying for having been uttered so softly. Then Schroeder raised his voice. "Mevrouw van der Velde," he called. "Madam, you are safe. It is Colonel Schroeder come to rescue you." The vines veiling the entrance to the cave rustled softly, and Katinka stepped out timidly from behind them. Her huge violet eyes were brimming with tears, and her face was pale and tragic, adding to her appeal. "Oh!" she choked with emotion. Then dramatically she held out both hands towards Cornelius Schroeder. "You came. You kept your promise." She flew to him and stood on tiptoe to fling both her slim arms around his neck. "I knew you would come. I knew you would never leave me to be humiliated and molested by these dreadful criminals." For one moment Schroeder was taken aback by her embrace. Then he folded her in his arms, shielding and comforting her as she sobbed against the ribbons and sashes that covered his chest. "If you have suffered the slightest affront, I swear I will avenge it 100-fold."
"My ordeal has been too terrible to relate," she whimpered.
"This one?" Schroeder looked at Hal and demanded. "Was he one of those who mistreated you?" Katinka looked sideways at Hal, her cheeks still pressed against Schroeder's chest. Her eyes narrowed viciously, and a small, sadistic smile twisted her luscious lips.
"He was the worst of all," she sobbed. "I cannot bring myself to tell you what disgusting things he has said to me, or how he has harassed and humiliated me."
Her voice broke down.
"I only thank God for the strength that he gave me to hold out against that man's importunity."
Schroeder seemed to swell with the strength of his fury. Gently he set Katinka aside, then turned on Hal. He bunched his right fist and punched him hard in the side of his head. Hal was taken by surprise and staggered back. Schroeder followed him swiftly, and his next punch caught Hal in the pit of his stomach, driving the wind from his lungs and doubling him over.
"How dare you insult and mistreat a high-born lady!" Schroeder was shaking with fury. He had lost all control of his temper.
Hal's forehead was almost touching his knees as he gasped and wheezed to recover his breath. Schroeder aimed a kick at his face, but Hal saw it coming and jerked his head aside. The boot glanced off his shoulder and sent him reeling backwards.
Schroeder's rage boiled over. "You are not fit to lick the soles of this lady's slippers!"
He braced himself to punch again, but Hal was too quick. Although his hands were tied behind his back, he stepped forward to meet Schroeder and aimed a kick at his groin, but because he was hampered by his bonds, the kick lacked power.
Schroeder was more startled than hurt. "By God, puppy, you go too far!"
Hal was still off balance, and Schroeder's next blow knocked his legs out from under him. He collapsed, and Schroeder set on him, using both feet, his boots thumping into Hal's curled-up body. Hal grunted and rolled over, trying desperately to avoid the barrage of kicks that slogged into him.
"Yes! Oh, yes, yes!" Katinka trilled with excitement. "Punish him for what he has done to me!"
She goaded Schroeder, driving his violent temper to its limit.
"Make him suffer, as I was made to do!"
Hal knew in his heart that she was forced to reject him now, in front of this man, and even in his hurt he forgave her. He doubled over to protect his more vulnerable parts, taking most of the kicks on his shoulders and thighs, but he could not ride them all. One caught him in the side of the mouth, and blood trickled down his chin. Katinka squeaked and clapped her hands to see it flow.
"I hate him! Yes, hurt him, hurt him! Smash his pretty, insolent face!"
But the blood seemed to bring Schroeder to his senses again. With an obvious effort, he curbed his wild temper and stepped back, breathing heavily and still trembling with rage.
"That is just a small taste of what is in store for him. Believe me, Mefro, he will be paid out in full when we reach the Good Hope."
He turned back to Katinka and bowed.
"Please let me take you back to the safety of the ship that waits in the bay."
Katinka gave a pathetic little cry, her fingers on her soft pink lips.
"Oh, Colonel, I fear I shall swoon."
She swayed on her feet, and Schroeder leapt forward to steady her. She leant against him.
"I do not think my legs can carry me."
He swept her into his arms and set off down the hill, carrying her lightly. She clung to him as though she were a child being taken to her bed.
"Come along, gallows bait!"
The sergeant yanked Hal to his feet by the loop around his neck and led him, still bleeding, down towards the camp.
"Better for you had the colonel finished you off here now. The executioner at Good Hope is famous. He is an artist, he is."
He tugged hard on the rope.
"He'll have some sport with you, I'll warrant."
A pinnace brought the chains to the beach, where the survivors of the Resolution's crew, both wounded and unharmed, were squatting under guard in the blazing sun. They carried the first set to Sir Francis.
"It's good to see you again, Captain."
The sailor with the irons in his hand stood over him.
"I've thought of you every day since last we met."
"I, on the other hand, have never given you another thought, Sam Bowles." Sir Francis barely glanced at him, but scorn was in his voice.
"It's Bosun Sam Bowles now. His lordship has promoted me," said Sam with an insolent grin.
"Then I wish the buzzard joy of his new bosun. 'Tis a marriage made in heaven."
"Hold out your hands, Captain. Let's see how high and mighty you are with bracelets of iron on you,"
Sam Bowles gloated.
"By Christ, you'll never know how much pleasure this gives me."
He snapped the shackles onto Sir Francis's wrists and ankles, and with the key screwed them so tight that they bit into his flesh.
"I hope that fits you as well as your fancy cloak ever did."
He stepped back and spat suddenly into Sir Francis's face, then burst out laughing.
"Ha! I give you my solemn promise that the day they reef you your topsails for you, I'll be at the parade at Good Hope to wish you Godspeed. Ha! I wonder what they will send you. Do you think it'll be the fire? Or will they hang and draw you?"
Sam chuckled again and went on to howl.
"Good day to you, young Master Henry. It's your humble servant, Bosun Sam Bowles, come to tend to your needs.
I did not get a glimpse of your yellow hide during the fighting, Hal said quietly. Where were you hiding this time?
Sam flushed and swung a handful of heavy chains against Hal's head. Hal recovered and stared coldly into his eyes. Sam would have struck again, but a huge black hand reached up and seized his wrist. He looked down into the smoky eyes of Abberley, who crouched beside Hal. Abberley said not a word, but Sam Bowles stayed the blow. He could not hold that murderous stare and dropped his eyes, keeping them averted as he knelt hurriedly to clamp the chains on Hal's limbs. He stood up and came to Abberley, who watched him with the same expressionless gaze as he hurriedly screwed the shackles onto him, then passed on to where Big Daniel lay. Daniel winced, but uttered no sound as Sam Bowles tugged brutally at his arms. The bullet wound had stopped bleeding, but with this rough treatment it opened again and began to weep watery blood from under the red headcloth that Abberley had used to bandage it. The blood trickled over his chest and dripped into the sand. When they were all shackled together, they were ordered to their feet. Supporting him between them, Hal and Abberley half carried Daniel as they were led in a file to one of the larger trees. Again, they were forced to sit while the end of the chain was passed around the trunk and made fast with two heavy iron padlocks. There were only 26 survivors from the Resolution's complement. Amongst these were four ex-slaves, of which Abberley was one. Nearly all were at least lightly wounded, but four, including Daniel, were gravely injured and must be in danger of their lives. Ned Tyler had received a deep cutlass slash in his thigh. Hampered by their manacles, Hal and Abberley bound it up with another strip of cloth salvaged from the shirt of one of the dead men who littered the battlefield like flotsam on the windswept beach. Parties of green-jacketed musketeers were working under their Dutch sergeants to gather up the corpses. Dragging them by the heels to a clearing among the trees, they stripped the bodies and searched them for the silver coins and other items of value that had been their share of the booty from the Standvastigheid. A pair of petty officers painstakingly searched through the discarded clothing, ripping out seams and tearing the soles off boots. Another team of three men, their sleeves rolled high and their fingers dipped in a pot of grease, probed the body orifices of the corpses, searching for any valuables that might be tucked away in these traditional hiding places. The recovered booty was thrown into an empty water cask, over which a white sergeant stood with a loaded pistol, as the keg filled slowly with a rich booty. When the ghoulish trio had finished with the naked corpses, another gang dragged them away and threw them onto tall funeral pyres. Fueled by dry logs, the flames reached so high that they shriveled the green leaves on the tall trees that surrounded the clearing. The smoke of charring flesh was sweet and nauseating, like burnt pork fat. In the meantime, Schroeder and Cumbrey, assisted by Limburger, the captain of the galleon, were taking stock of the spice barrels. They were as officious as tax collectors with their lists and books, checking the contents and weights of the recovered goods against the original ship's manifest and marking the staves of the kegs with white chalk. When they had made their tallies, other gangs of seamen rolled the great barrels down to the beach and loaded them into the largest pinnace to be taken out to the galleon, which lay anchored out in the channel, under the new mainmast and rigging. The work went on all that night by the light of lantern and bonfire and the yellow flames of the cremation pyres. As the hours passed, Big Daniel became feverish. His skin was hot, and at times he raved. The bandage had at last staunched his wound, and under it a soft, crusty scab had begun to form over the ugly puncture. But the skin around it was swollen and turning livid.
"The ball is still in there," Hal whispered to Abberley. "There is no wound in his back for it to have left his body."
Abberley grunted.
"If we try to cut it out, we will kill him. From the angle which it entered, it must lie close to his heart and lungs."
"I fear it will mortify." Hal shook his head.
"He is strong as a bull," Abberley shrugged. "Perhaps strong enough to defeat the demons."
Abberley believed that all sickness was caused by demons that had invaded the blood, It was a groundless superstition, but Hal humoured him in his belief.
"We should cauterize the wounds of all the men with hot tar."
This was the sailor's cure-all, and Hal pleaded in Dutch with the Hottentot guards to bring one of the pitch pots from the carpenter's shop in the stockade, but they ignored him. It was after midnight before they saw Schroeder again. He strode out of the darkness and went directly to where Sir Francis lay chained to the others at the foot of the tree. Like the rest of his men, he was exhausted, but able to snatch only brief moments of broken sleep, disturbed by the restless din and movements of the work gangs and the weak cries and groans of the wounded.
"Sir Francis," Schroeder stooped and shook him fully awake. "May I trouble you for a few moments of your time?"
From the tone of his voice, it seemed that his temper was on an even keel. Sir Francis sat up.
"First, Colonel, may I trouble you for a little compassion? None of my men has had a drop of water since yesterday afternoon. As you can see, four are grievously wounded."
Schroeder frowned, and Sir Francis guessed that he had not given orders for the prisoners to be deliberately mistreated. He himself had never thought that Schroeder was a brutal or sadistic man. His savage behaviour earlier had almost certainly been caused by his excitable nature and by the strain and exigencies of battle. Now Schroeder turned to the guards and gave orders for water and food to be brought to the prisoners, and sent a sergeant to find the chest of medical supplies in Sir Francis's shattered hut. While they waited for his orders to be carried out, Schroeder paced back and forth in the sand, his chin on his breast and his hands clasped behind his back. Hal suddenly sat up straighter.
"Abberley," he whispered. "The sword."
Abberley grunted as he realized that on Schroeder's sword belt hung the inlaid and embossed Neptune sword of Hal's knighthood that had once belonged to his grandfather. Abberley laid a calming hand on the young man's shoulder to prevent him accosting Schroeder, and said softly,
"Despoils of war, Gundwani. It is lost to you, but at least a real warrior still wears it."
Hal subsided, realizing the cruel logic of the other man's advice.